It was just a weird.
Yeah, it just seemed like such a waste of time. What are you doing? You said fine.
Well, they're good for me.
So I'm guessing everybody's waiting for me. So we can start.
Worth it.
You demand.
Thank you. We will start with the Pledge of Allegiance.
Pledge allegiance to the flag
of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
And the meeting's been properly noticed?
Yes, it has.
Thank you. We will go next to recognitions.
We have none this month.
We have none. All right. Then we'll, our first public comment period is next. Anyone from the public wishing to speak? This is restricted to items on the agenda, I believe. Go ahead and please state your name. Thank you.
So I just wanted to say, just in the minutes of the last meeting, that there was an error, and that was just that it was not Tim Jones, but it was Bob Beers who asked for what I said to go to Dr. Iser. So I just wanted to make that statement. And also, I'm glad there is an official record for it, because when I read the minutes, you can easily take some of the things that I said out of context, because it wasn't put in there exactly correctly. And some things were just not there at all that I said. So there is an official record, though, and people can read that if they want to. But the other thing that I would just want to mention, because you are going to be talking about the fee schedule change for the event coordinator for the Environmental Health Department. And I would just hope that there's some healthy debate over that, because when you get to the large events that they're talking about, and there's really only a few of those a year, that extra $118 an hour can wind up being a very large balloon payment that somebody just didn't know that all of a sudden they have at the very end of that. You don't know it ahead of time how many people you're going to need out there. These people, the inspectors, are not going to be out there on overtime. Through the contract, we have determined that in any of our large events like that, our people will be adjusting, so there will be no overtime charges for the people going out and doing any of the large events. So just want you to know that. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else wishing to speak from the public?
Hello. Hear me? I'm Melissa Smith. There we go. I'm Melissa Smith, Senior Director of Convention Services at the Las Vegas Convention and Visitors Authority. And I just wanted to make comment. I've been working very closely with the Environmental Health Team, especially with Rose Henderson. She's been very helpful with helping me through the process. But I just wanted to go on record to state that my understanding is that the tasting fees for trade shows will not change, and that this is just associated with the temporary food establishment fees. I hope that's correct. Okay, thank you.
If you have questions, I think you can get with staff afterwards. I'd be happy to answer your questions.
Will we not also be able to directly answer that question when we get into the public hearing?
We could do that, absolutely. Okay, anyone else wishing to speak from the public? Okay, we'll close public comment and move on to adoption of today's agenda.
So move.
Second.
Second.
I have a motion and a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? That motion carries. Next is the consent agenda. Do we have any changes or a motion?
No question.
Approve it.
It looks like it's just the minutes on the consent agenda. Is that correct?
That looks correct, yes.
Okay. I think you need a second.
Second.
If you need it.
Well, without having paid as close attention as Victoria might have brought to us, do we need to correct if
the
it matters?
Minutes?
Brought the request for.
I would recommend approval with that one change from Tim Jones to Bob Beers.
Yeah, if minutes really reflected what actually happened in meetings, we'd all be in a lot better shape. Okay, so we have a motion and a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? That motion carries. And next is item Roman numeral number 4, the public hearing action items. And it looks like we've got one item on that segment, which is memorandum 04-15, consider adopt proposed Southern Nevada Health District Environmental Health District event coordinator fee schedule.
Jackie Rezitar, Director of Environmental Health. I'd like to introduce Rose Henderson. She will present the event coordinator fees for this evening.
Oh, I don't mind being right here. Thank you.
Yeah, it's at the bottom. Down there. There.
That one.
Right here?
One over.
To the right.
There you go.
Thank you, Dr.
Okay.
Good evening, board members. I'm Rose Henderson, and I'm the Environmental Health Food Operations Manager. And what we're bringing forward for your consideration today is an adjustment to the event coordinator fees for the traditional special events. And just so we have kind of a distinction between the more traditional special events and those that are tasting events, I'll start off with a little bit of the boring part of this, a few definitions. But essentially, we're looking at the special events, which per state regulation and per our regs are transitory. Hello? Are transitory public gatherings that take place at a given location for a specific purpose. It has a defined start and stop time, and it doesn't exceed 14 consecutive days. And we typically see two different types of special events. There are the traditional special events where most of the food vendors obtain their own permitting. They are either temporary food establishment operators, annual itinerant operators, mobile vendors. And then we have the promoter or the event coordinator that coordinates all the infrastructure for that event and basically permits the various vendors to be there at the event, and they need to assure proper permitting of their vendors. Then there's the tasting events, which Michelle mentioned, there's usually a compensation that is collected up front, and that entitles participants to food or beverage, such as the wine tastings, the chili tastings, and so on. We are not looking at any fee changes currently for tasting events. Our research has been done on the conventional special events where we want to have a little bit more fairness across the board as far as the time that we spend is compensated. But then there's a more fair distribution of what that fee actually is. And that fee at the time of application is paid by the event coordinator, who's the designated person or person assigned by the event sponsor, who's responsible for the coordination of the food vendors and the health-related services associated with their event. And this is what we are proposing. Currently, whether it's a very small event or if it's one of our mega events, such as NASCAR or Life is Beautiful, all the event coordinators pay the same amount, and that's $290. And I believe back when that fee was discussed, it would pay for about an hour of pre-event planning, because good pre-event planning prevents problems the day of the event, so the event goes much smoother for the event sponsor. And then also it was paying for typically about an hour of overtime at time and a half, using that $118 per hour. So I believe that originally was how that $290 was derived. But we did do a year of research looking at close to 400 special events that happened during that calendar year. And for the most part, with the smaller events, those events that only had about 2 to 10 vendors, we can give a cost savings for those smaller events. And those really equate to about 60% of the events which we see here in this jurisdiction. And we looked at both the cost of the fees associated with the temporary food establishment vendors plus the event coordinator, because we're just trying to cover the amount of time it takes to pre-event plan plus actually do the inspections at the event. And hopefully time will tell, but it is my thought and my recommendation that we can cut that fee in half for those smaller operators. So the small events that take place in our parks that a number of people participate in, it's still very important we have an event coordinator, because that's the person that's responsible for a lot of the health-related activities associated with that event, but we want to have a bit of a cost savings for them. So we are recommending that we cut that fee in half, which I know there's not very many circumstances where you hear a fee's being cut. But we want to do that for a fairness aspect. When we looked at about the medium-sized events, which typically take more than one inspector, it can take multiple inspectors, I'd say the vast majority of the time, not all the time, but the vast majority of the time, the $290 covers the involvement we have to have with the event coordinator. So we want that fee to stay the same. For the large events, these are the ones which I believe Victoria made mention to. And those are the events that do vary greatly as far as the resources we have to put out for them. And we still want to keep the base fee as far as the event coordinator fee when they come in and they first apply at that $290. Staff have been very careful to track all of our time associated with events. And it did come up during the public hearings. Could a large event coordinator ask for maybe about how much time has went into the pre-planning and what we expect based upon the footprint of the event, how many inspectors we need out there to assure we look at all the solid waste concerns, all the water concerns, all of the restroom concerns, et cetera. We can always give them a running total. And with these large events, that really only amounts to about 10% of our events total. About 30% are medium and about 60% are small. So that with the large events, we don't want to charge them any more than what it costs as far as our time being out there with them. So that after the fact, we're not going to charge overtime, we're just charging straight time. And an hour of staff time, whether they're doing it under the contract on a mandatory adjusted, which they only do once per quarter per the contract, it's still, we're only going to be billing them back for straight time, not time and a half. So that's a bit of a correction from what a misconception might have been earlier. So that I'll be happy to explain that further if there's any questions. But that kind of explains this slide. And then this just goes over a little bit of what I've spoken about already about the small events. We do want to offer that savings. The medium events, we will continue to track, but it's just going to be the $290 event coordinator fee. And the large events, we will be keeping track of the time. And it's not just the $290, which the event coordinator fees will pay initially. We'll also look at the total amount of money which the temporary food establishments have brought in as far as applying for their inspections. And it's only after we total up that amount, if our staff time is exceeding what has been paid, then we will bill after the fact at just the straight $118 rate. So that's what we are proposing. And I guess I shall open it up to questions of the board.
Any questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Lois.
Do these categories cover when they're selling food in schools, say at high schools?
No, ma'am. The only time that a special event would be considered when it's on school property, because schools do not have to pull event coordinator applications on their own property, because they fall under the state law where if nonprofits have a special event on their own property, they don't have to get a permit for that as long as it's done occasionally. So this would be Only if a nonprofit, be it a school, be it a church, be it any nonprofit group, is going to have a public gathering or a special event off their property.
Well, if you're at a high school now and you're selling treats or whatever, or healthful food, if that's the case, are you charged any fees then at all by the health district?
It would depend upon whether it's an off-site vendor or not. If it is, say, I know the student
this is
stores.
On-site. I'm talking about the people at the school selling it as they raise money. You know,
oh, a fundraiser, yes.
Well, but they do it regularly at the school in raising funds for, say, the athletic department or the music department or something like that.
That would be a school-affiliated group then, am I correct in...
Yes.
If they're doing it occasionally, I know it falls under that exemption. This does not have anything to do with them selling on a regular basis on school property. These are transitory events.
I see.
That would be
would
a public venue.
Would you just happen to know off the top of your head what would be charged for a school that had something every day?
Okay, I might even defer to our plan review person because that goes through the plan review program. Because there are some, it depends if it's an off-site vendor or a school-affiliated group.
This is a vendor, and they came to me. They're at Clark High School, and they have to pay a fee that is of enough cost that it makes their profit much less than it would be, and they're earning the profit for library, for athletics, for whatever. And they came and asked me about that, and I told them I'd check.
Yeah, that's
so I'm
not related
Shoup.
To this discussion.
I supervise the Facilities Design Assessment and Permitting Office, formerly known as Plan Review. So we bring in all the permits with the exception of the temporaries and special events. We've had numerous discussions regarding the fundraisers that happen at the school. At this time, if it's the school itself that's running that food booth, there's no charge for a permit on that. If it's an outside vendor that's bringing in and operating the booth, then we do have a permit fee for that. And I'm sorry, I don't know off the top of my head what the fee is.
Well, that's all right, but because I think you've answered my question, it is done by the school itself, and they are paying money because they complained to me about it. So I'll just go back to them again, and if you have your card or something, I'll give that to them so they can contact you.
Okay, sounds good. Thanks.
Thank you. Tim and Chris.
Right, a couple of items. I believe that we clarified Melissa Smith's question that tasting events where there's a single payment to attend would not be a part of this new function.
This is not a part of this discussion at all. We wouldn't even consider changes to that until we do about the same amount of research as we did for even bringing this forward.
Two more items for me. One is, what would be our start date?
Dr. Iser, Jackie.
Well, if you approve this today, I would probably recommend July 1st.
Okay, I would agree with that, just so we can let industry know what that will be. And then lastly, I would request that we do at the end of July 2016 then a review of the program overall, looking at the impact fees, the revenues, costs to conduct, sure. How many of these events fell now into the large group versus, into the other groups from a year ago.
Yes, sir, we can certainly do that.
So we ask for that review.
And I just want to add that the small events were sparked by Horseman's Park a year ago when I arrived, so it's taken us about a year to come up with a concept that seems to fit.
And just kind of a general concept, I know for the larger resorts, there are more events that are coming as outdoor festival type events, Rock in Rio, things of that nature. And so as that inventory of events comes about, I believe that there are some events that will be kind of on the hook for this unknown extra fee at the end of the event. And the issue is to try to manage that and be able to project that. Nobody wants to have service that they don't pay for, but we do want to know that there's not 10 inspectors coming out when it only takes two to get the job done, that type of thing.
Absolutely. And during the pre-event planning, we will sit down with the event coordinator and outline what we look at. And there have been some of the larger events that 60-plus that they were so organized, they had everything together. It didn't take a lot of pre-event planning. And the cost was covered with the temporary food establishment permit fees and the $290 fee, and there was no additional fees. It ran from that up to the Gambit, where when it was a very large footprint, there wasn't the level of organization. Just to protect the public, we had to spend more time out there. And we don't want to charge that across the board to all large events. That's why we thought that this model would be fairer to everyone involved. But we can keep the event coordinator up to date on how much resources we've put in and we would anticipate to put in. We'd be more than happy to do that.
Just, I mean, I'll finish with this. One concept is a resort may sell an event to various clients to participate, and those can be as far as 3 years out. So certainly they'll know that if they are willing to do their legwork and have everything in great order, the fees will be low.
Absolutely.
But they need to be able to project those costs.
If I may, I believe, Ms. Resnitzer, didn't you and I go and talk to Rock and Rio over at the county building?
Yeah.
To try to give them an idea of, well, we would have two things going on at the same time, the EMS and those fees, as well as the food service fees. So we met with them early on. This would have been, I think, 2 months ago.
A month ago, at least.
Okay.
Chris.
Question. Thank you. Several questions. What does it take to become an event coordinator?
There are no pre-requirements besides the application. Currently, they don't have to. Anything with special events, they do not have to get a food handler card. That's why it takes a little bit more time with those individuals to assure they have the background to assure the organization of the event. And it would be nice to say that everyone has the same level of knowledge coming into a transient event. However, a lot of our events do come where they're Their promoters come from different areas, not just of the country, but of the world, like with Rock and Rio. Really, some of the individuals dealing with our locals are from Rio de Janeiro, and they don't have maybe the same food safety built into their special events, so that we have a great deal of variability, which with those that have the stronger background, we spend less time with them because they already know how to set that up.
That's my question, then.
Yes.
So we just make them fill out an application, and I get to call myself an event coordinator?
There is no requirement for them to have a food safety certification.
I'm talking about food safety certification.
Yes.
An event coordinator, mm-hmm. in my mind, is one who knows what permits are required, what days you have to do it, when you have to do it, who do you have to go pay, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily who does, why would you
yes.
need a food handling, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. That doesn't make sense. So what I'm trying to find out is, do we even define, I mean, we define an mm-hmm. event coordinator, but who certifies that it's an event coordinator? So when a resort or someone hires someone as the event coordinator, you know what you're getting.
There's no certification from the health department standpoint.
Okay,
currently.
Is there anything any place that we know of?
No. Well, the colleges
okay.
will have someone who might take a designated area of study in event coordination. I have a daughter who's...
It just triggered in my mind because you're right, because otherwise if somebody isn't coordinator or isn't familiar, they're going to drive up the cost for that event
right.
just because of their lack of knowledge, not
right.
because they need to know food stuff. They don't, in my opinion. It's the all the other workings. It's like a zoning person that has to know all the land use and all those different pieces. That just might be something down the road to take a look at. I'd like to see the research that you conducted.
Okay.
Because to me it goes a little bit more to what Tim was just talking about, is after the fact. I'd like to see what the research was that triggered the changes. I have the majority of the strip in my district. Mary Beth has some, but I have been called by both smalls, mediums, and larges. And with no disrespect, I don't think there's a time crunch here for this adoption. They've asked me to set up some meetings with some of them, and I'm going to accommodate that part of it. So I'm going to ask tonight that we maybe not move forward on this, but at least we can get our questions out there so that when I meet with them, I understand better what's going on. So the research would be very helpful to see what generated this. So when you broke out, you said 60% were the smalls.
Mm-hmm.
30% were the mediums and 10% were the large?
Yes.
Okay. What money do you generate with those 60%? What does the 60%, the smalls, the mediums, and the large each generate revenue-wise?
What we were finding overall, and we had to deal with typicals looking at the five different offices and asking them to look at all of their events in those categories. And for the vast majority of even the mediums, the 290 was paying for it. With the small ones, we really wanted to give the smaller event coordinators a bit of a break because it is a smaller footprint when you're dealing with just 2 to 10 vendors, typically a smaller event. And with the event coordinator, as far as what their responsibilities are with the food regulations, they basically list what food vendors they're going to allow at their event, and then they do take care of the event infrastructure. So they don't have to be food safety experts, but it's good if they have a good degree of organizational skill.
That's to me.
And we try and limit the amount of time that we have to be out there really impacting their event by the pre-event planning.
So, but do you know, like, does a small event for the last year, does it generate $1 million? What do we generate?
Basically we looked at typicals for those size of events and whether we were covering the cost of the staff time out there to inspect the food vendors plus the infrastructure of the event. And we could give the cost savings to those smaller events across the board.
I'm trying to find out what does the large generate, what does the medium generate, and what is the smalls. And if you don't have that tonight,
we have it broken out, we just don't have it available. I think
it would be helpful for me to see when I meet with these folks to see what's happening with that part of it. Now, in your definition, the 290, I think you said, Rose, was originally derived for the pre-event planning plus 1 hour of overtime.
Yes.
Okay, but I don't believe we pay for overtime any longer.
We do pay for overtime for all but the one section in the contract where it talks about the mandatory adjusted work week. And once per quarter, staff can be required and scheduled with 2 weeks of notice to adjust their work schedules.
Okay, so your mega events, their adjusted work schedule according to
the contract.
The larger
events, yes.
And then anybody can be called back in. Again, then that would be a number I'd like to see what we've actually cost in overtime since you put that change into effect, because I have a feeling it's probably not even there any longer. And so if we derived a fee based on something that no longer is really happening, then perhaps the fee overall should be adjusted, not just for the smalls. Are we surveying the large events? Are you requiring the surveying of large events?
Surveillance of even the medium as well as the large events, a lot of that is based upon the initial inspections to see whether there's a good handle on the food safety practices by the vendors and then the overall waste disposal, the overall restroom coverage. And for a multiple day event, a large event, there'll be some degree of surveillance, but it's based upon the public health risk, how much we would be out there to
ensure. Have we always done surveying of events?
Actually, we have with a number of events. It, again, would be based upon what we were seeing as far as the accountability and the level of organization which the event coordinator had at their particular event.
So we're paying inspectors to go out, do pre-event, do the event planning, then go out and inspect, and then we're adding more people to just survey the events just to see if something might be happening?
It might be just a minimal surveillance.
What's the maximum surveillance?
Well, I'll tell you, for something like NASCAR, where there are hundreds of thousands of people involved, and there are a very high number of food vendors, a very large footprint, we would have a couple people out there on maybe day two and day three to assure everything is still, the solid waste is being picked up, the restrooms are being maintained. And it's usually a short survey. It's not an intensive thing like when we're actually issuing the permits the first day.
So who pays for that part?
That essentially, we've been covering the hourly cost, and those larger events, we are having staff work the adjusted work weeks, and the hourly fee associated post-event with the large events will just be straight time. It's not time and a half.
I'm not worried about that. So how many people? Cause sometimes it's intimidating to a business as well to have 10 people walking around surveying.
No, ma'am. Not for surveillance.
Ma'am, the way good public health is run is if we have a big event like NASCAR, we would maybe send one or two inspectors out just to walk around the the base, if you will, just to catch something. It's not a full inspection. It's just overall surveillance.
Okay, so who pays for that?
Right now, it's just we do have to pay the straight time for our staff, even if they're
doing the adjusted
work weeks.
Right.
It has been out of the budget, but for something like NASCAR, and we are going to do a cost analysis of just the last NASCAR, but that was one of the examples which we looked at in this overall analysis. And it did cost us more than the fees that came in order to cover our staff time out there. And there's other things that make it kind of difficult as far as getting a staff into just certain venues, not all of them. But things that happen up at the Speedway, oftentimes there's a lot of security for various understandable reasons, but there have been circumstances with certain events, one not NASCAR, but one that was a non-car related one up there within the past year, where staff, due to very limited parking, they weren't allowed to take their private vehicles. We could only have them transported up there in a health district van because they'd only offer so many spaces to park. And then they were held up at the gate for some reason for about 45 minutes. And that was a van of 9 people being held up that we couldn't have them doing other work because of the coordination not being quite where it should be with that particular coordinator.
So you had 9 people in a van to go out to survey after somebody...
To do inspections, to issue the permits initially, because there was about 100 vendors out there, okay. So we needed to get that number of people out.
And that makes sense, if it's the initial,
yes,
that makes sense. So surveying is just an interesting concept, but it's something that was brought to me by
a
constituent. And something we may want to look at a little bit further. So are we having infractions? Are there infractions for folks at this point?
Yes, there is. I've been out to events, and unfortunately some of the basic things that you would want to see in place are not there at the time when they assure us they're going to be ready for inspections.
Give me some examples.
Sometimes not proper hand washing, lack of sanitizer. Sometimes they don't turn on their warm and holding equipment as timely as they should. We find foods off temperature. So we find risk factors for foodborne illness, which we try and mitigate with them when we get out there. There are some events that, due to their good practices, and they read all of the pre-event checklists and the educational things which we hand out to them before the event, they look excellent, and we're in and out of there. So that we see the whole spectrum, we really do, with the special events.
So has industry been informed that overtime is basically gone for their mega events at this time, and it's pretty much straight time so that they can do their adjusted?
And again, that's why we are only considering charging for straight time $118 an hour, not time and a half.
And then is there something called back charging?
I don't know what back charging would mean. We would bill them for the additional time that we had to spend out there over what the temporary food establishment fees and that $290 base fee would be.
Is that for the surveying, or is that for sending your inspectors back out?
It'd be callback.
Well, surveillance would be anything that takes place if it's a multiple day event, and only the number of people that the director would feel needs to go out to take a look at a problem would be going out on those.
I'm just trying to understand, so I know
of
when
course.
I meet with the industry,
of course.
I was told the term back charging, and that could be fees that build up that no one realizes, and when they try to do
their
events and budget for it.
We should advise them how much has been spent and how much we anticipate. I think that should be on the forefront, so nobody is surprised after the fact.
But is it at this point?
Not
currently. We're not back charging. It's just $290, which sometimes with these large events don't cover the cost of getting staff out.
I appreciate
there.
That, but under this
yes,
new
ma'am.
Proposal, back charging could exist?
No.
It would be a charge per hour for anything over what has already been paid, but we can give them an ongoing accounting
okay.
of
All
that.
Right. Thank you. That's my question
yes,
for
ma'am.
Right now. Mr.
The terminology of back charge, I understand it to be, there will be a charge of $118 an hour above and beyond $290 for any additional staff time required. That could be as a part of the initial setup, it could be a part of the follow-up surveillance. whatever it takes for health district staff to.
That may be, but I'm telling you, I'm hearing from industry both sides, and so I'd like to be accurate before I move forward personally on any of this stuff. That's all.
We're trying to keep these fees very conservative and really only covering the cost of staff time.
And I just want to clarify one more time with the surveillance. It's not to hinder anybody. It's just an extra protective measure that we should provide during these large events.
I understand that. Perception is, you know, just depends on how it happens and what industry feels. And so I told them I would ask the questions tonight and then ask them.
Okay, I just want to make clear that surveillance is not supposed to hinder anybody. It's supposed to help.
Okay, let's go to Bill and we'll work our way back towards Bob.
Mr. Chairman, the calls that I got, and I got a fair amount on this issue, are around two key points. One is everybody seems to appreciate the business approach you took it, you know, looking at the fees and doing some math and doing some analysis before just deciding what the fees ought to be. That said, there was some, to Tim's point, there was a lot of conversation about, well, let's go back a year from now, at least a year, and look at see what really happens, because some people are questioning whether the fees at the high end are legitimate. I mean, are they too high or are they too low? And they just like to see the same math and the same analysis done on those fees as you did for the other fees. But overall, the comments were pretty positive that I received. And they were glad that you took the time to do this.
I have a question. I just have a simple question. I run an event. The event ends tomorrow. When do I get balance billed for the extra peer personnel and time? How long? A month? 2 months from now? 3 months from now?
Well, I'll tell you, Dr. Osgood, I would hope that it'd be a lot sooner than that. This is something new which we're going to be embarking on. However, I do expect, even with like the NASCAR event, which just happened, the supervisor, even though we had multiple staff out there, he's got his analysis almost done on that.
So I could, it's reasonable to expect within 30 days that I'd be balanced.
Oh, absolutely. If we can't do it within 30 days, we got to look at what we're doing. So I think I can honestly say within 30 days we should be able to culminate everything that happened. Both pre-event planning we should know, because we should give you a running total of how much that was. We should be able to tell you and anticipate how many staff need to go out. And typically, because you want us in and out of your event quickly, you don't want us still inspecting when crowds are trying to get fed. So that it's a very narrow window to get the staff out. So normally we will staff it with the number of staff that we can get in and out of your event, hopefully within a couple of hours if everyone's set up properly, because we want to be out of your way so that your patrons know they have a safe product, but then we're not infringing and taking time from them serving the public.
If I get balance billed 6 months later, can I ignore the bill?
You know what, if you get balance billed 6 months later, we have something wrong with our system. And I agree with you there. That would be ridiculous, someone having to wait that long.
Bob?
I rarely hear people comment that my city moves too quickly on things. Tonight's vote would have to be unanimous, if I'm not mistaken, Annette.
This is a fee schedule, it's not a regulation.
So we don't vote?
You vote, but the regulations require a majority of board members. The fee schedule is not a regulation.
And the so part just about having to have the, in the absence of the majority of the members, this was Terry Kerr's change to the law that I've seen invoked at my city council meetings.
And county, too.
Doesn't apply here?
On fee schedules?
You're amending a reg, aren't you?
It's
fee. It's just not a regulation. It's just a fee.
So do we have to have a majority of the quorum that's here? Or?
Correct.
Okay.
May I just mention that really the fee is staying the same for, or it's less for 60% of the affected individuals looking at the last calendar year. 30% it's staying exactly the same. And the 10%, if their organizational skills are like some of the ones which I've seen, and that's why I didn't want to have an increase fee across the board, we're basically keeping just the base fee the same as it is right now, so that anyone that has that level of organization will probably not even be be charged per hour. But as soon as we know, because we'll know how much came in with the temporary food establishment operators plus the $290 base fee, we'll know very quickly whether they should anticipate $118 per hour and how many hours we could forecast for them. Because we're talking about out of 390 special events where they did require an event coordinator, this is maybe 39 of them. And they are the ones that in some cases did cost more, but some of them, the costs were covered. So that kind of puts it into a perspective. Yes, some people will be affected, but there'll be ongoing conversations with them, and it's probably going to be about 39 or about three dozen of the 390-some events that typically take place during the calendar year.
Mr. Chair?
I've still got some questions. So is 390 the total annual volume of
numbers for last year?
Non-tasting events?
Yes, sir.
Traditional events. There we go.
Yes, we did break them out further from what we proposed.
So I'm just trying to figure out the 60%, 30%, 10% of what? It's 390.
Yes. Okay. I can tell you that for fiscal year 13-14, we had a total of 393 events which required an event coordinator. 235 of those had vendors, 10 vendors or less. So that amounted to 60%
overall. Is that like a farmer's market at the park up in my
neighborhood? No, sir. A farmer's market's a different category. Right. So these are the special events. So they're the transient events.
An event with under 10 or 10 or under vendors.
Horseman's Park. Sometimes they only have about 5 vendors there. And just with the fees from the temporary food establishments, which covers the time inspecting those. What's left over is what we walk the property, check the restrooms, check for solid waste disposal, check for, just overall, right, health associated with the event.
And each of the food vendors, mm-hmm, of which at a small event there are 10 or less, also have to permit for each event that they attend?
Per the regulations, they would be considered, if they have a point of sale at their booth, a temporary food establishment, so that we do inspect them per that part of the regulations for all of their food safety, because they're the responsible party for the food that they're bringing there, that it's from an approved source, that it's held at proper temperature, for their hand washing capability, sanitizing utensils, and so on.
That makes sense. And so the total revenue for an event is the sum of the 290 for the event overall for the EC, mm-hmm, and then each of the food vendors.
The food vendors, and that's why we wanted to cut the costs for the smaller events, because we're finding that it doesn't take as much time with that footprint to assure the public health and safety associated with the overall organization of the event. That's why we want to cut that fee in half for the smaller events.
I think one of the things that generally businesses want is predictability.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if there's some way to either scale the fee up for much larger events, like if you're at how many food vendors are at NASCAR?
A lot.
100?
Probably about 100.
Okay.
Yes.
So maybe the break points need to be 60, 80, and 100. So that they can get some predictability based on our average costs of those large events, and maybe a potential for you to award a discount for particularly organized event coordinators, because they seem to not cause as much problem. The open-endedness of this, it would be a fearsome thing for a large event promoter, and they can build any amount into their fee they charge the vendors. But they need to know up front what they're kind of looking at. So if we did, even if we went with the open-ended suggestion tonight, I'd like to see an amendment to, at least on a subsequent to the first event, they have an estimate of what last year cost them. Does that make sense? Just something to provide some predictability to the promoter.
Plus, what I would like to see in the pre-event planning, since we can focus back on some of the very large events and we can get that cost analysis for them, to sit down with them and talk about strategies that may have not been as successful last year for them, and things which they could do to basically have those risk factors under control so it'll cost them less. And I would rather keep the staff time to a minimum, because we're looking at just protecting public health, and if we can do that in the pre-event planning, and then we spend less time out there, I think that that's in everybody's best interest. So I can assure you, with these larger events, we have pre-event meetings with individuals, and for the most part, we have a number of inspectors that were there last year, which could be part of those pre-event meetings, and talk about what worked and what didn't work with them. We did that, actually, not to name a particular event, but this is a real success story. Life is beautiful. Their first year here, it was a bit disorganized, and there were a number of problems out there. But the event coordinators came in the second year with us months in advance, and they definitely looked at the footprint. They made some definite improvements. We had a safer Life is Beautiful the second time around compared to the first. And a lot of that was the operator who sat down with us and took the time to just adjust a few things that made their operation run so much more smoothly. And it really protected the public health more. So that we are committed to doing that with the larger events. I would rather just get the base fee in and not charge anyone anything more unless it takes us more time. And I think accountability for us is very important in that. In that, during those pre-event meetings, explain all that to them and talk about how they can be successful in running their event properly. Because ultimately, it is their responsibility to run the event properly. If we need to coach and mentor them on how to do that, the pre-event planning is just critical in that. And it develops relationship where no one's worried about when we come out, they'll know exactly what we're looking at.
Is there a way to calculate a worst case scenario daily surcharge and notify them of that? Is it?
If I may. I like to give examples. So when I was the health officer and the director up north, we had a very famous event, and I guess I need to name it. It's the barbecue cook-off. And the pre-event planning went well. It usually goes well every year. We went back the next day to do surveillance, and a bunch of the vendors had improperly stored and improperly cooled their barbecue. We eventually had to, I actually had to call one of the owners of Esquaga. I knew Michonne, and asked her to intervene because we were getting a lot of pushback from the vendors. And we sent the material out for bacteriological testing, and had we not spent a whole lot of extra time that next day and a little bit more time the following day, we would have had a lot of illnesses. I don't remember what the agents were, but there were bacteria growing on the pre-cooked material that we found. That's why I would, to you if I could, I would suggest that you can't predict when that will happen. And so trying to predict a fee up front for a large event such as that one would have underestimated the cost to the health department.
But if you can say, we since we can't pull people in the Reno example, Sparks technically.
Sparks, you're correct.
If you can't bring in additional health inspectors on loan from San Francisco, there's a finite number of people you have times a daily rate is a number. Disastrous, worst case scenario. At least for their planning purposes, quantifying the cost of the permit up front, even in knowing it's a worst case scenario, and there's definitely things you can do, Mr. Promoter, to bring this number, make sure this doesn't happen to you. But I don't know if that's possible.
It could be, but when you think of, what do we have, 100 food inspectors? At least 100 food inspectors, and how many hours will it take? I think that would be difficult to tell.
Well, let's say 800 a day.
Well, I can tell you that all 100 inspectors would not even be out there at NASCAR. We probably had a contingency for 100, about 18
at most. Understanding that, but I'm coming up with the worst case scenario. 100 inspectors a day for 8 hours is about, what, $80,000? $100,000? I mean,
That would be something that I have never seen in 25 years here. I know that it has ran into, you know, a couple thousand dollars where we had people out. You know, but talking about all the special events that have been here in Clark County, I don't think we're going to see an $80,000 fee. That would have to be an absolute nightmare.
So quantifying and that top end
probability
would be of assistance to the people who are putting these events on, quantifying that worst case scenario, understanding that you're not committing to it. Mm-hmm. It could be worse than that, sir, but that would be of benefit to the people who are putting these events together, and these events are part of what put the city on the map and drive most of this economy.
One thing we can do with the events that happen every year here, because we have some wonderful events, and we have inaugural events coming in just this year, but the ones that have happened before, we can look back and look at staff resources that went into them last year, and as part of the pre-event planning, sit down with them and show them the cost breakdown. And say, now, these are some things which took us a little bit more time with you. Let's work with them on the pre-event planning end so that you can have everything ready so that you're serving a safe product when we come out. And we don't have to have all these interventions, which causes a lot of disruption for your event. And I think that's something that my staff would do with something like this, because I'm going to be holding them very accountable for how they're keeping track of this. Because this is something that's a little far-reaching, but I would rather not charge someone if we can cover the cost. And it's going to be even fewer of that 39 that are going to actually be charged something after the fact. And I think we can keep a running total and give them anticipation throughout the process. Because there's only 39 we're dealing with, and I would rather cut the cost for so many more and then very closely and hold my staff accountable for how they're keeping track of the time and resources we're putting out there and try and prevent the problems through the pre-event planning. So I think that focus on 36 to assure that we don't charge them any more than we should, but that we only cover our costs and that we're very accountable as to what those costs are. But I can save it for so many of the smaller operators,
right,
and I'd like to do that.
It sounds like it's doable, given the small number of mm-hmm. the mega events, to notify each one of them at the time they bring in their
Absolutely.
Permit request. Here is what your fee would have been last year mm-hmm. if this structure was in place. And that seems to me something that we should include in anything that we move forward with tonight. Mm-hmm. Is this in the budget that we looked at last week?
No, and actually there's not so much an increase as a decrease.
Just the question is whether or not this is in the budget. When we saw the budget last week, we also realized that there are potential changes in revenue for many, many potential reasons. Mm-hmm. And my question was whether or not this was in the budget, and it's not.
And how much over budget neutral would it be? Any estimates for that? Because you're lowering rates on 60%
right.
and keeping 30% exactly the same, and maybe not increasing the upper 10%. My guess.
It sounds like it would be a fairly simple analysis, since we can do 90% in two columns of a spreadsheet and then analyze each of the 39 to come up with what the overall budget impact would have been if this had been in place last year.
And I have some help with finance on that. But to see the cost savings for the small ones, that's relatively easy. I'm sure we could get the other things, but it would be essentially $235 times $145, and that's revenue that we would not be bringing in if we had that same number for the next fiscal year. But there's a fairness with that. If it doesn't cost us $290 for the vast majority of those smaller events, I don't like charging them. There's a fairness involved there.
I think that your concern was more, would we be bringing in more, or was it more or less?
Actually, my concern was, do we have a pressing reason to do this tonight?
Fairness for the small
operators. Just the fairness for the small operators that we've promised to the three commissioners, including Collins, two who sit on this board.
And there's no change in fee as long as it doesn't run over not just what the event coordinator fees, but also the temporary food establishments. all that will be added up before we'd ever charge any hourly cost.
It sounds like the analysis of what the budget impact would be from this is within grasp, but not here.
We can send that out to you over the next
the
week or so.
What's the harm of waiting for 1 month?
Actually, there's none except that we will have the pool regs on next month, too, the new
pool. Is this
pool
seasonal?
Special events?
Yeah.
Special events, there are some ebbs and flows. During the spring and during the fall, we have more special events. They slow down a little bit after the 4th of July and maybe a little bit after Christmas, but then they start picking up in March through about the 4th of July. Then there's a little lag, and then come around September, they go up again for all of our fall events that we have here. So it ebbs and flows a little bit.
We could
really, the smaller events happen throughout the community, and we'd like to see the savings for them. And we might end up just breaking even when it comes right down to it, because probably over $19,000 we won't be taking in because of cutting that special event for the small events.
We can bring back the answers to these questions next month, not do the full formal presentation if that's all right with you all, and just bring back these questions, these answers.
Okay, those are all of my questions, although to put them in order, the ability for an event coordinator to predict or have some feel at least for what they're up against here is very, very beneficial.
Mr. Chair.
Chris and then Tim.
Thank you, and I apologize. I'm not trying to delay anything other than when I got the calls and then I looked at the agenda, it said consider or adopt, and I looked at the posting and it said that if it's not presented the March 23rd, it'll be presented at the regular board meeting April 23rd. I didn't think that there was any rush to have to act. And then tonight you said that July 1st would be when it would go into effect anyway, so it doesn't hurt the smalls at all, because nobody would have any effective date. So I just wanted to be able to get answers for the folks that raised some issues and understand better myself. So if you can get me the research, no matter what happens with the vote tonight, when we're doing fees, we have to be very sensitive. There's some pros and there's some cons. And I remember when Collins came to my office going rah, 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 about the and Mary Beth does too, about the Horseman's Park, that's a legit reason, but that's why the research is very important, because as you try to help one side, you also don't want to punish somebody else or make the cost more prohibitive on the other end. So that's
I'm sorry.
That's fine.
I'd recommend that you all table this until next month.
I so move.
Okay. I just have a question. You could answer it when you do come next month. Do you have an idea in your mind as to the worst case event, as you were doing your analysis, how many hours additional would that one worst case have required in the last year?
I looked at some typicals with the very, very large events. Those are the events that, take a great number of staff. Sometimes we have very limited parking so that they have to go in group. I did have one that I'm thinking of right off the top of my head that actually the fees covered the cost of doing business, even though it was a very, very large event. Then I had one that ran actually a couple of $1,000s over. And then I had one that, and it was a very large event that does bring in millions, I'm sure, and they ran probably, I'm trying to think, the worst case scenario I think I saw recently because of just all of the pre-event planning was about $7,000 over. And that was one that was very problematic. But we can get you some of the research with each one of those and how the cost breakdown went. I'd be more than happy to do that.
And ultimately, Mr. Chair, this is about compliance.
Yes, sir.
Right. That's the end point. Hopefully you don't have to charge anybody because everybody's a good organized operator.
So you had said there are 235 small events last year?
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. There were 235 small events and then about 128 medium events. And then the remainder, about under 40, were under the large to the very mega events.
So if there are 235 small events last year, mm-hmm. you're getting 145 less per. That works out to be about $34,000 that they have to make up with the large events, which, and you said there's 106 large
events? About 128 for the medium.
And
then about 39 for the large to the very, very large.
Yeah, so you got to make up about $873 per large event, and that's, 7 hours worth of time.
And there are some events that, with the fees, with the temporary food establishments, plus that $290 base fee, we wouldn't be charging them anything additional. It's just for the staff time it takes, if it takes more time. And I would rather not have a large event that we didn't put the time in on. I don't want additional money from them. That's why I like having just the base fee. And then for the ones that are taking more time, have a very, very large footprint, maybe have multiple food areas within maybe an 18-block area, then it'll take us more time to look at everything we have to look at to assure a safe operation. Yeah. And then it's just the cost of us being out there and doing the actual work, because who else should be paying for that other than the person that we're inspecting and assuring that everything is running properly with their event?
With NASCAR being in the recent past, do you have an estimate of how many hours, man hours, woman hours?
As I said, the supervisor's working on that, and he had some preliminary numbers on Friday, but he needed to crunch them and put them into a table where it's something that's presentable. I'm sure we could have that for next month, yes, if you would like to see that.
It sounds like we have some board members who would.
Certainly.
I appreciate the comments. I do believe, like Councilman Beer said and others have reiterated, that the pre-planning is important. I heard you talking about forecasting, and I think that's important, even with first-timers, trying to get a range of what they can expect, and then not just leaving it at that and going out and doing your inspections and then surprising them at the end, but, you know, all along trying to reassess. And if you think that there's major issues, you know, having some more meetings to let them know that, look, these are big issues we're going to have to address. You can expect some more fees coming because we're going to spend more time out there. Mm-hmm. I believe that's important.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
One more question. I didn't really see anything in the workshop or the PowerPoint that addressed the late fee component. Is that consistent with what we've been doing?
We've never had, as far as the late fees, yes, sir. That has always been in the fee schedule, so we didn't want to be misleading about that, so that we put it on there. That essentially is there because sometimes we have people that come in at the very last minute. We can't do the pre-event planning, or else I've got to divert people from other things in order to do that effectively. And if a large event comes in less than 7 days before they actually want to have the event, they do incur a 50% fee on top of that 290, or now it would be on top of the 145 for the smaller events. If they come in with less than one business day and then we have to scramble to get people out there at the very last minute, then it is a double fee.
And that's consistent with what we've
That's
been.
Consistent with what is currently on the fee schedule, except for the small event coordinators, they'll have lesser fees because it's 50%. For the 2 to 7 days, and then it's 100% late fee if it's less than one business day, so that they'll actually get a cost savings there too.
Mr. Chair, just as a final, Rose, do we license, like business license in the counties or cities, event coordinators?
You know, each one of the jurisdictions handles how they handle their special events and use permits a little bit differently, just from my conversation with the various business licenses. But they do have to pull some type of use permit, which is separate from what we require them to do, but I believe the individual jurisdictions have requirements.
Thank you. I'm going to take a look. Maybe we should just look into that, because again, that's the threshold premise of how you contract with somebody who knows what they're talking about, and maybe we can look into some kind of process to make sure that they're holding themselves out, not just as a flyby, but actually have some background in
event planning of some sort. So that may be something that might help you all as you move down the line on the time side of it.
Working with the other governmental entities would always be very much appreciated, just in some conversations, because I was a supervisor out in Henderson for quite some time. And I did speak with the city of Henderson, you know, over the years, you know, as they would bring individuals in, you know, as far as their use permits. And some people definitely are, well, as with any business, some people are more professional and more informed than others. But since there's not specifics as far as accreditations for something as transitory as special events, that's part of what our pre-event planning is about, because some folks, they just knock it out of the ballpark. They're so organized. And I just don't want to have to charge them more because they're a larger event,
exactly,
because they handle it very well. And then there's some people that we do have to teach, coach, and mentor, but we do have to cover the cost of our staff doing that, and only that cost. That's what we're trying to achieve here.
And I don't disagree at all that it should be user charged and directly for those times.
But we should let him know how much it's going to cost.
Maybe we can help
it
be a little bit better if we had some kind of a process. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Oh, yeah.
I don't think it should be held to it.
Plus or minus 10%, that sort of thing. But yes, nobody wants surprises like that. It doesn't look good for us either if we don't have good accountability, and we understand that.
The idea of certifying the event coordinator seems to have some merit to it, but I would tell you from the resort standpoint, it usually tends to be a food and beverage manager or a convention manager that takes that role who may have some background. So I don't know how many of these large events you might think are going to be resort-related versus other public-related, and that might be part of the analysis you bring back to us next month.
You know, Mr. Jones, part of that is that when we looked at the overall large events, most of the resort corridor, it's more the tasting events that are the truly large events. Now, Rock and Rio might be one that's going to kind of break that mold, but the majority of the larger events weren't necessarily associated with the resort corridor.
Buy your tickets. Sorry.
Anyone else? Do we have a motion or directives?
I don't even know if it means a motion. Just bring it back on the 23rd, as you noted, and for action at that time.
Can you move that?
I would give that direction, Mr. Chair.
Or move to obey it until the 23rd, or?
Yeah, to hold till the 23rd and bring that back.
Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Are we going to have a vote on that or just a direction?
Is direction sufficient for you?
My preference, because it was agendized as a public hearing item, I'd rather have the motion.
I so move.
Move to obey, is that what you're saying with the so move?
Correct.
I'll second that.
All right. We have a motion and several seconds. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? That motion carries. Thank you. All right. We will move on to our Roman numeral number 5, report, discussion, action. Sub number 1 is consider Health District budget for fiscal year 2016.
Good evening. I'm Sharon McCoy Huber, Financial Services Manager. I don't think so.
It doesn't sound like it's on.
I don't know what I did.
I just have a softer voice than Rose. Hello?
It froze because it's so cold in here.
Okay. Okay. What we've got before you is the budget presentation for the fiscal year 2015-16. It is on your iPad. Also, if you so desire, where I'd like to start is the health district's. The health district's vision statement is healthy people in a healthy Southern Nevada. The health district's mission statement is to protect and promote the health, the environment, and the well-being of the Southern Nevada residents and visitors. why the health district prepares an annual budget. First off, it's required by the state of Nevada. And secondly, it's submitted to Clark County no later than April 1st every year. The big changes that are being proposed in the 2015-16 budget, staff took to the Finance Committee a new fund type. They wanted to add special revenue funds or grant funds. Primary reason to add the special revenue funds is that it's easier to balance and manage. The grant funds should always be in balance, the revenues equaling expenditures. What will change by adding the special revenue funds? Reports would show the grant funds and the general fund separately. It allows managers to see how much grants actually cost, including the health district indirect cost rate. It also allows board members to see how much the general fund is supporting the grants. There would be a clarification that needs to be made is that general fund, in maintaining a minimum unassigned fund balance to the general fund and special revenue funds of 10%, which was action that was taken in November of 2014.
It's fine on this one.
So in reviewing the total revenues by source, this is the general fund and the grant funds combined. It shows that there's a $67 million. And of this $67 million, $21 million is regulatory fees. $19.5 million is property tax. Federal grants are $5.5 million. Title 19 and other is $2.4 million. Fees for service is $6 million. Pass-through grants is $9 million. And state grants is almost $3 million. The big increases in this year's budget were federal grants. We received two new grants, Healthy Start grant for approximately $731,000. We also received the PITCH grant, which is Partnerships for an Improvement in Community Health, of $2.7 million. We are in the 2015-16, currently there's an increase $567,000 for property tax allocation. There is $472,000 for Title 19 immunizations. And those are the primary increases in revenues for the 15-16 year. Now, if we looked at the funds, this would be the grant funds, which were proposing to move to special revenue funds, and these would be the general funds. And as you can see, the grant funds would be just the pass-through grants, the federal grants, and the state grants, which is $17.5 million. And then the general fund revenues would be the property tax allocation, the regulatory fees, and the fees for services. If we go into the expenditures and we look at the expenditures combined, the general and grant funds together, you can see that the salaries are decreasing to $33.2 million, and from the original budget of $33.8 million, the estimated budget of $34.2 million. The primary reasons for the decrease in salaries is we reduced the number of staff positions by 13. Those are currently all vacant positions. But it also has the merit increases for those that are eligible, and it also has the reduction in salaries due to the PERS increase, because staff does have to absorb half of the increase in PERS. And bringing that up, the fringe benefits and payroll taxes increased to $14.2 million, which is the increase in PERS from 25.75% to 28%. And then if you look at services and supplies, there's an it's going down from the current estimate of 18.2 down to 17.8, but it's an increase from the original budget of 15 million. The primary reason that it has those changes is the pitch grant. It's approximately $2 million in service contracts. There's a $500,000 increase in scanning, and then there's $400,000 increase in immunization costs. And then we also have a decrease in lease payments of approximately $800,000. So if you look at your expenditures by division, you can see that the main change is from community health and nursing and clinics. Your environmental health pretty well stayed flat, and your administration stayed flat. It went down a little. But your community health had an increase, a big jump of $4 million, and nursing and clinics had a reduction of approximately $4.5 million. The primary reason for that is that they are moving the disease investigators from nursing and clinics into community health. So with that being said, what we've got here is an analysis of the staffing by division. As you recall, from 13 to 14 and 14 to 15, that was primarily the reduction there were the layoffs of approximately 62 positions. The original budget to the estimated budget, that that increased because of the new grants. And then the reduction into the 15-16 proposed budget, that's eliminating 13 positions that are all vacant at this time. So with all of that being said, the combined general and grant funds, the change in fund balance last year was $8.2 million. We budgeted a deficit of almost $4 million. We're currently at estimating our deficit to only be $1.3 million. And we're proposing next year's budget to be a deficit of $1.9 million. We began the year with a $12.8 million fund balance, which the appropriate level of unassigned fund balance is 20.5% at the end of the last fiscal year. In November, they took action that the unassigned fund balance can't go below 10%. And at that same time, they also recommended moving, or you also recommended moving $1 million into an emergency fund balance. And so you'll see that in the estimated, or the original budget was 11.09% of expenditures. We're now estimating the fund balance to be 16.15% of expenditures. And then the 15-16 budget, we're estimating a 13.26% of expenditures. So that's the real, the finance committee, we met for 2.5 hours and in great detail.
Like just 1 hour.
Oh, okay. It was a quick hour. And we went over in detail the moving of the special revenue funds and those types of things. So first off, I guess if there's any questions.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Beers.
Could you remind the board what the reserve should be by policy and by law? That appears to be 13.26% at the end of fiscal 16.
Yes, sir. The budget we're proposing will leave a 13.26%, which the action taken by the board in November of 2014 is that the unassigned fund balance cannot go below 10%.
And state law, does it specify a lower number?
There's a minimum that we can't go beyond, which is something like 4.5%.
Could you use your mic? I can't hear you.
Oh, now. I'm sorry. There's a minimum of, I think, around 4 or 4.5% that we can't go below.
It's 4%.
4%.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
Was our board action just for the year to do the change in ending fund balance, or I didn't think that that was an ongoing, such that if we're going to continue to go under it, we need to have another motion to do so. It would be my understanding.
You're correct. It was a temporary waiver. Right.
The original budget that we had for this year would have brought us below the 10%. That was your new board policy, and so we got a one-year waiver on that, but we aren't going to go below 10% this year. So the 10% is an ongoing recommendation, or not recommendation, it was an ongoing motion that was passed by you all.
Right.
But we had lowered.
The previous was between 16.66% to 25% is where the unassigned fund balance was to be, was what the policy was prior to November of 2014.
I thought we had a hard number that was higher than 10%. 16 sticks in my head.
It was the 16 to 25%
answer. 16.6 to 25%.
Yes, it was a range.
Yeah. That was your old policy. You changed the policy after much discussion to 10%, primarily because we set aside the $1 million for emergencies, which is well above the state mandate. The one-year exemption that you gave us is because it was projected that this year we would fall below 10%, and so you gave us a one-year exemption for that below 10% with the expectation that this coming year, this budget we're talking now, would be above 10%, and it is.
So do we need to extend for another year then?
No. We're fine.
Mr. Chairman, what date will we know what the value of the ad valorem tax amount will be?
We're scheduled to receive that information probably the morning of the 26th. The county gets that information on March 25th.
Yep, 4:49.
At 4:49, thank you.
Anyone else? Okay, do we don't take any action on this, right? So just
These are the recommended actions, so I would keep these in front of you for after item
two.
Three.
Right.
So we take them all together then?
Yes.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I have one quick question.
Yes.
Just on back on your Southern Nevada additional fund types and the creation of the special, will that designate state, federal, and other grants, or are you just going to lump that all grants into that one fund?
All the grants will be lumped into the special revenue funds. On the county side, it'll be as one fund type. On our side, it'll have probably 25 different
okay,
funds.
Okay, so you'll still be able to break out. So,
yes.
Because you said part of the rationale was so that board managers can see how much grants actually
right.
cost. But when you commingle the state, federal, and
right.
whatever the third one was, they may lose that. But as long as they're able to still filter that out.
Correct.
Then, okay. Thank you.
Anything further before we move on? Okay, we'll go ahead and move to item number two then. The three, review, discuss the three-year budget projection.
Before you and also on your iPads, you should be able to see the three-year projection. And as shared with you, the 2015-16 we projected that we would have a 13.26% budget. And then for the 2016-17, we're projecting a deficit budget of $718,000 or a 12.3% of expenditures to fund balance. And looking at that graphically, what that does is this shows you historically back to 2010, we were at 28.3%. And then the current last year, we were at 12.9%. We're projecting out the 10.6% is our estimate as opposed to the 6.2 as what was originally projected. 8.6 in 2015-16, and 7.9 in 2016-17.
These are dollars or a percentage?
Those are dollars, millions, $7.9 million.
I thought I heard percent.
The percentages are
on the previous slide.
Previous right. page under the green line. No, the purple line.
It's the purple line. The 13.26% and the 12.3%. Are there any questions on the three-year projection? Kind of as a reminder, Dolph.
Do you have a question?
I'm sorry.
If you want to finish that.
What I was going to share with you is that in the three-year projection, there are some unknowns, like the community health improvement plan, because we don't know what that plan's going to present to the board. There are no numbers in the plan for that. And also, any new leases that we enter into, there are no projections for new leases at that time. And then a subject of vector mitigation is not projected in future year budgets either.
Could we get a report or some kind of tally of what we've spent in outside attorneys' fees over the last year or so? So we know, I'm assuming you would project, that's what you would talk about when you project out.
Right, and the state mandates that every other year that we tell them how much we've spent, and we did calculate it this year, and it was $88,000.
Okay. And then environmental health, we'd had a discussion. They're not subsidizing other departments at this point because, again, we had that conversation about fees should be for that department, not for other areas.
Do you right. They're not subsidizing those. In fact, this coming year, 2015-16, they're having to go into some of the tax dollars because of the scanning expenses that were unpredicted at the beginning of the year. So actually, they're going to actually need a little bit of the tax revenue dollars to help support them this coming year.
And the scanning, I'm sorry.
We're trying to move to a paperless environment, and so we've got budgeted approximately $500,000 to do scanning, and that covers all of the divisions, administration, environmental health, community health, and nursing.
That means all your forms and everything.
Yes.
But your back data is what you're scanning.
Yes.
At this point, I'm assuming then.
Yes.
Is what you're talking
Our
about.
Our stored medical records and other records.
Gotcha.
Okay. As you may know, they're almost all down in Henderson. And
right.
In order for us to get out in another year and a half, we have to get rid of that
How
material.
Long do you have to keep yours? Is it like our IRS for us for 7 years? Or, I mean, I don't know, with HIPAA requirements?
It ranges anywhere from 3 years to permanent records, depending on what it is. I know if it's a grant fund, it's 3 years after the close of the grants. And some of our grants last 5 years, and so we would have to keep those five years worth of records
plus the three, then. You would
and be. Then there are some records that we have to keep permanently. So.
And then, thank you. And then where is the capital budget? Is that separate from this? You know, the
capital budget, it isn't presented here. We did share it with the Finance Committee. We're projecting next year to spend approximately $4 million in capital projects. And the primary expenditure there is for an ERP. We went out for bids for an ERP this fiscal year, and they're analyzing the bids that came in to see what the recommendation will be. And then they've also got funds budgeted for an EMR, which is, I'm sorry, an ERP is a enterprise resource program. It does the financials, HR, all of those things. And then also we have to finish the EMR, which is the electronic
on medical records. Yeah,
yes.
That one I knew.
And then also,
okay.
There's expenditures for vehicles and software and hardware also in.
So do you then interconnect with, do you have to share your data with the state or county or anybody else that we should make sure your system, your ERP, does communicate if it's needed to be communicated? It may not need to be, but.
I don't think that our data needs to be interoperable.
Okay.
You may know, I think I might have mentioned to you when we met, I know I've mentioned to several of you, that we've been sending people out to the counties, to the city, to the water district, to the school district, to see if there's an ERP MP that we can glom onto, but they don't quite meet our needs, or it's going to be very expensive to do that, to buy extra licenses. So I think at this point, I actually put that on hold about a year ago to be able to do that, and I think we're now back to the point where we're going to have to buy our own. It's very expensive for 500 employees, but yeah. we have to do it. It's procurement. It's everything.
You're not writing your own, though. You're buying something
Yeah, we're going out for bids, and
Councilman Beers and I remember.
yeah, oh no, gosh. We're not going to write it.
Okay.
No. We're going out for bids, and I believe, Sharon, you mentioned that the bids are in now, and we're going to be analyzing them over the next couple of weeks.
The bids have been received. There were three responders.
And the ballpark dollar amount? Is it budgeted then?
Three.
Yes. We budgeted $3 million.
It's very expensive.
But once it's up, then that's pretty much it, and then there's maintenance, or how does that?
Annual maintenance, yes.
Yeah.
Thank you.
But we can't really move forward into the 20th century, hardly the 21st, until we do this. I mean, honestly, I think every county that I've worked at for many years now has had this kind of a management system for hours, for procurement, for promotions, for almost everything that we do.
I do have a question. Part of the reason we've asked for this in the past is, you know, trying to just look 1 year at a time it's not very effective. You know, you get tunnel vision locked into this year, and then you kick the can down the road to next year, and then you just look at 1 year next year. So we started this process of this three-year budget projection last year, and we're close to the end of the 2014-15, so really, in my view, it's only a two-year projection going forward. I think we're pretty much dialed in on what 2014-15 is going to end at. So the million-dollar question is, when do we add that extra year and start looking out another year ahead?
Well, part of this exercise, I think, for me and for you, was to balance the budget in 3 years. So we can add that new year in at any time, but the end of that three-year cycle has us with still a $718,000. Budget deficit, which my plan is to use any increment over the 3% tax revenues that we get to go to deficit reduction. And certainly over this year and next year, I think that amount probably will cover it. We're not sure, but we will look at additional positions that are unfilled to eliminate at that point if we need to do it.
And that's what kind of raised the question for me. I mean, I still see the deficit, even if it's a smaller number, and the trend is still downward to a lower end fund balance.
That's correct.
So at some point in the near future, we just need to look at the next year.
I did have a meeting with all staff and with the supervisors, as I always do, to go over these budgets. And I think it was one of the supervisors said, well, what are we going to do? When can we start building again? And I pointed out that we can't, because if you follow that trend line, it was like this. And now it's almost even, at least after 3 years, it's almost even. And I don't think we can start to build again until we see an uptick in additional funds, part of which will be grants, which may help to cover some of the indirect that we've been covering out of the county general funds. And then, again, whatever increments we get on four, Commissioner June Kiliani, 4:49 a.m. on whatever date that was.
I have a question.
Okay. 4:59, I goofed. Yeah.
Realizing that we have a new building that's going to come online next year, have you been, and you may have gone over this with the Finance Committee, if you did, fine, and don't repeat it, but do we have a good feel for the cost difference between, you know, what we're going to be spending with the new building, getting out of leases that we have, getting out of this building, and the equipment and the operating costs of the new building as compared to this one? Do we feel like, is that a big number, or where is that number?
That's all calculated into the figures that Sharon has just given you. We think that we'll need to add some more money to that over the next year or so. We also have, just to let you know, we have some renovations that we need to do at the laboratory. So that would come out of that budgeted amount as well. And as she pointed out, one of the unknowns is And I know you know that we're looking at going back into North Las Vegas. What will that lease cost, and how much will that cost us overall? So we need to we don't know what that is. As we're already in conversation with Henderson about working with them, as we are hand in glove with North Las Vegas, so that we can look at a new building or a different building or a better located building down there. And this, you can touch my arm if you want, but we have several meetings set up with North Las Vegas this week, and then Henderson is coming up in a couple of weeks. That will give us a better idea, and will better give us an idea of where we'll be at the end of the next 2 years or 3 years or beyond. But I can tell you I won't go into the same total amounts that we've allocated for North Las Vegas or Henderson. We just can't afford to do that.
This would be a good time for me to nominate Member Noonan to the Budget Committee.
Good.
Mary Beth, and then Dr. Osmond.
That was exactly the question I was going to ask about the building. We have the transfer to the building reserve fund. Is that what is accomplishing the capital project with the building?
No, we also have a capital project fund. The building, the transfer there, the $1,350,000, that's approximately based on the current budget for the building. That'll leave approximately $4 million in the building fund. But we believe that the cost for renovations is going to be higher than what's currently budgeted, because now that we've got the general contractor on board, we're starting to see some changes.
Issues.
So I think our challenge has been, until we get the building done, is we wanted to be sure to set that money aside so that way, and then also, like Dr. Iser shared, we're finding out we're needing to make some renovations to the lab, and we want to be able to come forward in a year and tell you what the building fund needs are going to be. And then our capital project fund has about $6 million in it.
And that's the capital funds are for the ERMP, for the other software, for the cars that we make. You know, a lot of our cars are reaching the end of their lifetime, so it covers that.
So do we anticipate about that amount being taken out again next year? Do we see that as a long-term?
If I may answer that, no, we don't. I think we're talking about a depreciation fund in subsequent years to this, depending on what we have. That's what the Finance Committee has recommended to us, but we're not quite ready to go there yet. But probably next year or the year after, we definitely should be.
The other question, I think you touched on it, but any additional funds that may come in from our 4:49 p.m., would that all be directed to debt?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. There may be a little bit more, and you all know, because I've mentioned to you that we've been talking to the jurisdictions about, as Sharon pointed out, vector mitigation. All we can do is surveillance right now, and the cities would like us to do more. You know, I know that the two commissioners here know that we've had conversations with the county and with the cities, and I can guarantee you that I think we only had two cases of West Nile virus last year, but those can change dramatically. And even though we wouldn't be the beneficiary of it, our health insurance policies would be, the county and the state would be to the if we could eliminate some of those. And probably a couple of neuroinvasive cases, if we can prevent those, that's where they get a meningitis and some die. If we can, and it's very costly care. If we can eliminate a couple of those, that seems to me to be a good place to put our investments in the medium term. I no longer am thinking in long term, which is good, but in the medium to shorter term. But I think that our community health assessment, our meeting with our partners, will give us a better idea of what we should be doing, where and when.
Dr. Oskin.
You brought up the community health assessment. I've asked periodically every quarter, do you have the staff you need to do the job?
We do.
And the community health assessment will help. How are you getting any closer on the community health assessment for us to project what our future demands might mean as we go through our 17-18 budget, that's all.
Well, by the end of this year, by December, we'll have the community health assessment, the CHIP, which is the engagement process, and then the strategic plan. So we have to do that in order to go forward for accreditation.
Correct.
And so we need all three of those really to do it. And I think it will be the engagement conversations about our community health assessment that will give us that information.
So it's conceivable that early next year or late this year, we'll be able to have a discussion of the needs.
Yes.
And how it impacts on our budget and how we might want to change it for future years.
Correct.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Just a final, how many cars do you have in your fleet?
23, I hear from behind
me. Do you have an interlocal with the county for our fleet management or anything along those lines?
No, we don't.
I don't know if that would help you at all, but
we can look into that. Please touch me if I'm saying something wrong. But I do have a conversation with Mr. Burnett. I think it's this week or next week about co-location with some of the county facilities.
Mm-hmm. Now,
and that might be something that we can discuss at that time, too.
Yeah, because we have our own Mr. Johnson, right? It just might be something that saves in the long run. And then do you, because we periodically will do an analysis on whether or not the cars should go or it's cheaper to pay mileage.
We have done that.
The vehicles, so. Is that mostly your supervisor inspector types or your folks that have to go out?
It's the people on the ground who usually use the cars. It's not the supervisors.
Okay, so you rotate on that part of it. So yeah. Even be nursing, I would think.
Yes, nursing does have some of the cars.
Okay.
I guess community health has some now, but I think the bulk are in environmental health.
Okay, thank you.
And it seems to me, you know, just we need some vehicles.
Oh, yeah, I'm not.
Because we can't carry chemicals and things.
Sometimes mileage is better, sometimes it's not.
It is.
It depends. But it just dawned on me that we have a maintenance facility and there might be some saving.
Okay. Other comments or questions? All right, we'll go ahead and continue moving on to sub-item number 3, receive report and accept recommendations from the March 11, 2015 Finance Committee meeting. And I believe we'll turn the time over to our committee chair, Chairman Beers.
I would move that we receive the report and accept the recommendations from the March 11, 2015 Finance Committee meeting.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? And that motion carries. Do we need to now circle back on the other two, or how do we want to do that?
Can I just ask a clarifying question? Part of the recommendation was that we change the ending fund balance from the 16.6 to the 25, from the range 16.6 to 25 to 10%. Is that?
I would include that in my motion.
That was included.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure that the record is clear on that.
And the addition of the different fund types.
The special revenue.
The special
funds.
Revenue funds.
Special
funds.
Revenue funds.
So we know how much we're spending in fixed costs.
And thank you.
Is that reduction to 10% temporary again, or is that permanent, ongoing?
That actually was voted on a couple of months ago as permanent.
Correct.
So I understood it was only the temporary allowance of less than 10% for next fiscal year that was a temporary one.
Okay.
I don't. You're remembering differently, but Jackie or Marcy, do you remember?
Either way, I meant to include that in my motion.
Okay. Very good. Thank you.
Okay. So do we need to vote on that motion then? And
Did we vote?
I don't think so.
We haven't.
I thought I remember saying aye.
I thought I said on that.
Yeah, we did.
Maybe I was the only one.
So then can we just amend the, well, we can rescind it and rescind that.
For what?
Isn't it the same?
Well,
I asked at the end of the item number 1 whether we needed to vote, and you said we would take all 3, so we moved on to 2 and then on to 3.
Well, you know what? I would move that we rescind the previous action that we just took.
Second.
And then clearly state the action that we're taking now.
Nobody changed that slide.
So this would be the motion.
Yes.
Motion.
A motion to rescind and needs a vote.
Yes.
All right. We have a motion. Do we have a second?
Yes.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? And that motion carries.
Mr. Chair, I would move that we approve the Finance Committee recommendation as shown on slide 10 of the PowerPoint presentation currently showing on our screens. That would include the approval of the one-year budget for 2015-16 and the creation of special revenue funds. In addition, if necessary, I would like to further resolve in this motion that the board set the ending fund balance to be equal to not less than 10% of our annual revenue.
Second.
And we're not taking any action on the three-year projection, correct?
Correct.
Okay. We have a motion and a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? And that carries.
But we sure do appreciate that three-year budget.
We do.
Yeah.
And all of the presentations. Thank you. Item number four is review, discuss environmental health update, food operations administrative process, and enhancement of the food safety message during the permitting process.
Becky Rezitar.
Oh, would you? There was a microphone.
She's got it.
Just go ahead and do
yourself. Oh, okay. Good evening. I'm Tamara Giannini. I'm an environmental health supervisor with the food operations program. And I'm not good at PowerPoint, so let's see how this goes. Where? That one? Thank you. So I was asked to give you a brief overview of the administrative process that we are currently using in the food operations section. The concept for the administrative process came about because we needed to answer a very important question. What do we do to support and assist food facilities that, for a variety of reasons, are having difficulties complying with our regulations? How can we help them? We do our best to teach, coach, and mentor them, but that's not always enough. The administrative process was first tested in 2011, and it was put out across all five food operations offices in April of 2013. And we have found that this is an effective method in turning facilities around. The operators acquire food safety knowledge that they need to actively control and monitor foodborne illness risk factors within their facilities. So what is the administrative process? It worked, yay. For facilities which exhibit a pattern of out-of-control risk factors for foodborne illness, the C downgrades or closures, the administrative process is a series of steps where we give the owners or their designee opportunities to become knowledgeable with food safety and operate their businesses within the parameters of the food regulations. As I'm sure you're aware, environmental health field staff spend a considerable amount of time in facilities when a downgrade occurs. We work to educate staff and problem solve. This may be accomplished by reviewing procedures if they have them, for instance, how they're cooling food. Maybe we're able to identify with our expertise gaps, areas where they could make improvements and change. Maybe we're at a lower level facility and we need to help them demonstrate how to do something, which we would, for instance, taking a proper food temperature. Are we cleaning and sanitizing the thermometer before doing? We have multi-language handouts that we can provide, and we do have translation services if needed. But unfortunately, with these tools that we have, we needed something more. We have limited staffing resources and the amount of time that an environmental health specialist can spend in each facility. Environmental health specialists alone cannot always get a facility turned around. So what is our next tool? And that was the development of the administrative process. An owner or designee that has a food facility that continues to have risk factors for foodborne illness, as evidenced by C downgrades or closures, will be called into an environmental health office, either with a supervisor or a manager, to be able to have a meaningful discussion with their assigned inspector as well as that supervisor or manager to obtain possibly some very basic food safety knowledge, to understand the food safety risks that we're seeing in their facility, and to work collaboratively with us to put some systems in place to control these risk factors. From these meetings, of which I've participated in many myself, the operators are very complimentary. They appreciate the meaningful dialogue. They thank us for our time. The office time is very beneficial because they're not in their facility distracted by the day-to-day occurrences of running a food facility. They're able to concentrate with us and discuss what they can do to change because they ultimately do want to find solutions to operate safely. And at each conference, the operator is informed that though it's our goal for them to be successful and to have a restaurant serving safe food within the community, that they are in an enforcement process with increased requirements at each step. The first supervisory conference, when the operator comes in for a meeting, at the conclusion, they are informed that their persons in charge, the people that they leave responsible for their facility in their absence, must have certified food protection manager training. If the facility continues to have C downgrades or closures beyond that point and they come in for a second supervisory conference, they are required to contract with a food safety consultant. And if they still continue to have difficulties beyond that, controlling the risk factors, a managerial conference is held where the certified food protection manager certification and the contractual agreement with a food safety consultant is again reinforced as tools that they need to put in place to control the facility. After a managerial conference, if a facility receives a C downgrade or a closure, at the time of that inspection, a letter is served to them that their permit is suspended pending a revocation hearing should they request it, so they are closed on site. And they have 5 business days to request a revocation hearing. Should they choose not to request the hearing, their permits are revoked after that 5 business day time frame has expired. Oh, now it didn't work that time. But the good news is that far more facilities turn around, can routinely pass on A grades, and are removed from the administrative process due to their successes. On average, there is only 1 revocation hearing per calendar year, compared to at least 29 documented turnarounds where operators became knowledgeable and implemented food safety in their facilities in 2014. Every facility is different, from the setup of their kitchen, which impacts their food flow and food safety, from the menu items they serve, from the employee demographics, including learning styles. However, this administrative process has proved to be a consistent, measurable process which has implemented across these barriers and holds facilities accountable and, more importantly, effective in improving food safety. The slide that is up currently shows that we have 222 facilities in the administrative process and that the first supervisory conference is there are currently 170 facilities at that step in this process. But by the time we get to the second supervisory conference, the number of facilities that still need our assistance is drastically reduced to 45. So that first step of requiring the certified food protection manager training turned around a vast majority of the facilities needing help. From the second supervisory conference to the managerial conference, you see that we went from 45 facilities to 7. So the requirement of a food safety consultant again helped a large number of facilities. And then at the managerial conference, re-emphasizing the importance for training, trying to give them that last outline and plan of how we can help them be successful so that we do not have to serve the letter and suspend their permits. Again, there was a very good reduction in that from 7 to 1. So we feel that this program in the last 2 years is certainly working. It's something we will continue to do, and we are evolving to find even more ways to reduce the amount of facilities that need to go through this enforcement process. And as we continue that goal of teaching, coaching, and mentoring facilities, we have added another process which will hopefully reduce that number. And I'm going to let Carla explain that, and then we can both take questions after the presentations. Thank you.
My teeth are chattering.
I'll hurry.
Not because of this. What if we open the door?
So Tamara just explained to you the administrative process, which is what permitted facilities go through when they have a history of downgrades and closures. And I'm going to tell you about a project that we've been developing since about August of last year to try and encourage facilities to come out of the gate with a permit with adequate food safety knowledge so that they never have to go down that administrative process. So we know that about 9% of our facilities that we issue a permit to get a downgrade or a closure at their initial grading inspection, and that grading inspection occurs 30 to 60 days after we issue the permit. So we've developed a program that we hope is going to reduce that number of downgrades and closures initially, and that they'll be able to build sustainable food safety practices in their facility that'll take them through the rest of the life of their business. So there's three components to the program. The first thing that we did was we revised our plan review process. So when facilities come in with their plans now, we're not just looking at the equipment and trying to say if their construction and design elements are meet the sanitary requirements. We're looking at their plans, but we're also looking at their menu, and we're trying to have conversations during that initial meeting that emphasize food safety. During that meeting, we get an idea of whether or not the operator has actual food safety knowledge. Sometimes we have those meetings and only the contractor or the architect shows up, and we don't have the opportunity to talk to the food operator. So we've implemented a second step in the process, which is the food safety assessment meeting. Now, not every single operator needs to come in for a food safety assessment meeting. It's just those operators that we identify that might have difficulties or that they're not able to demonstrate to us at the initial meeting that they have adequate knowledge. Food safety assessment meeting is designed to be an informal meeting. The plan review inspector and the assigned operations inspector sit down with that restaurant owner and anybody they want to bring with them. It's real informal. We try to make it fun. We have little, you know, fake food and thermometers and stuff. And what we try to do is get them to demonstrate what they know about food safety in the context of their menu. So we ask them questions like, you know, when are you supposed to wash your hands? Tell us how you train your staff to wash their hands. What's proper cooking temperatures for this particular soup that you make? How do you cool it? How do you train your staff? How do you ensure that they're following your directions? It's really interactive, and then at the end of that meeting, we make a decision as to whether or not we think they can proceed to get their final inspection. If we decide they're okay to get their final inspection, that's what we go do. If they still have issues during that meeting, there's two options. They can either go home, study the regs, study the information that we give them, and come back for another meeting, or they can hire a food safety professional. They still have to have another meeting with us, though, just to make sure that they've got the risk factors in their facility under control at that point. The other point at which we might require a food safety assessment meeting is on a change of owner inspection. So that's a facility that's open, that's just changed owners. Somebody new has walked in, taken over the business, and continues to operate it. What happens with those facilities is they don't have an initial intake meeting with us. We actually just go out into the field and do an inspection for them. So what we're trying to do now is when we call to schedule that inspection is we're offering the opportunity to have a food safety assessment meeting before we go out there, because if they get more than 10 demerits, they're closed and they can't operate again till they come into that for that food safety assessment meeting. So we're trying to kind of mitigate that and say, hey, this is an option. If you want to come in before we do your inspection, we can help you out that way and possibly prevent a closure that's going to shut you down for a period of time till we can get you up to speed. The last component of the process is the collaborative final inspection. So our operations inspectors meet our plan review inspectors out in the field to do that final permitting inspection. Gives them an opportunity to further build their relationship with the restaurant operator. It helps the operations inspector become aware of any construction issues that might be outstanding that need to be corrected prior to the final permitting inspection. I've presented this a couple times. I typically get asked about legal authority, so I just included these last two slides. NRS 446 says that when an inspection reveals that the applicable requirements of the chapter have been met, then we can issue the permit to the applicant. And NAC 446.823 allows us to issue a written or oral examination prior to issuing a permit, so we feel we're covered legally on that. Just some stats. We started this project back in, we started thinking about it back last August. We started testing the meetings back in November. So to date, we've done about 50 food safety assessment meetings. And now we're moving on. We just had our last training session with our staff last week, so we're kind of cutting them loose to do them on their own. For the next 6 months, we're going to collect data. We have reporting schemes in place. We have data collection schemes in place. So hopefully over the next 6 months, we'll get some valid data to see if this new program actually helps cut down that initial downgrade closure rate and if it has an impact long-term on our overall inspection rate. So now we're going to go ahead and we're going to take questions regarding either the administrative process that Tamara discussed or the revised permitting process that I just went over.
Dr. Osgood. Got a couple of questions, epidemiological question. Approximately how many licenses have you issued? If I understood you right, we're talking about 2,500?
Over what period of time?
Well, you said about 9% are downgrades. And you've got 222 downgrades last year, so I'm guessing
We're looking at different data. Yes. We're looking at apples and oranges, unfortunately.
About how many?
So what I looked at was the total number of downgrades and closures that resulted over a 12-month period following that initial release of a permit.
Which?
So I didn't have, I'm sorry, I don't have the total number off the top of my head. That's just the ballpark figure for
ballpark. Ballpark, how many? Ballpark, do you have a couple hundred downgrades this last year? And you're licensed, about how many licenses are out there in our county?
Close to 19,000?
Yeah.
19,000. So we're only talking, 1% of the, a downgrade of approximately 1% of the licensees.
Potentially, yes.
Is that what we're talking about? And of that 1%, you guys have been able to turn around all but a couple of them.
Correct.
Through the administrative process.
Through the administrative process.
Yes.
How many do you have on your staff?
How many inspectors? In the food program, are we around 50?
53. For 19,000 restaurants. Okay. That was my question.
We're busy.
You're busy people.
Thank you. Mary Beth.
You mentioned training, that if they get past the first
supervisory conference. Yes.
That they're required. Do we offer that to them, or do we have, I see too, we have approved, they have to complete a course on your side, a course of instruction that's been approved. I just wondered if we offered those, or if we have a list of approved trainings and courses? Or
that's a great question. We don't offer the training. There are four ANSI-accredited exams held by many different courses, and we have a FERL document, a Food Establishment Resource Library document, where when they come in for this meeting, we present them with some website links and some information where they can go to get the training.
Great. So it can be online, easily accessible.
Yes.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Chris.
Follow up on that, then. What's the cost to them for that?
They do vary. I've heard, I haven't looked at it myself, as low as $99 up to as high as $200. It depends on which company they go with. If they want to do a self-study course where they order the materials and then go to a proctored testing site, or if they want to go to a facility where they can actually sit and participate in an 8-hour classroom setting day and then take the exam following that.
And this is for the operators?
Correct.
Only if they're in the third step, or this is for all now?
So in the first step, the persons in charge for the facility are required to have, thank you, are required to get the Certified Food Protection Manager training. As they continue through the process, though, it's not something where we say, oh, now that you have a consultant, you don't need that. We're just building on more tools and hopefully the combination thereof makes them successful. And we have had concerns from industry brought forward that unfortunately these exams and classes are not offered in all languages yet.
That was going to be where I was going.
Right. So I was personally involved with a facility that they attempted to take the course and exam in English, but Thai was their primary language. So they actually went themselves and decided to just hire a food safety consultant early on that could work with them, and that's always an option for them as well, though we do realize there's an increased cost with that.
A large one, especially for your small mom and pops. So okay, so help me understand. Everybody now has to be certified program training if they're the operator of the restaurant.
So this is only for the, and he's much better with numbers than I am, for
only
the,
for the 1% that have been downgraded.
Only the 1%, the
99% don't have to have anything to do with this, if I understand you right.
And that's because they triggered a problem.
Right.
Correct.
So why don't we work with our community college to come up with a training program on site so that we're not making people have to spend, because a couple hundred bucks each time around and all the other fees to a small business can be a make or break on their piece, rather than whatever, what would you call it, ANSI, Nancy? Or
oh, ANSI, yeah, ANSI accredited.
ANSI, Nancy. I've got Nancy in my pantsy now, so I'm just sitting here. But anyway, to me, because there's a standard that we have expect, and with our cultural diversity in this community is just phenomenal, which we should applaud, and we don't want people, I think, to judge people because their food, you want it safe, but I believe in germs, but we'll have that in another discussion at another time, but I think we have to be sensitive to making sure that culturally they know what's accepted here, but not try to put them out. So I just think maybe you found a gap that maybe we ought to be taking a look at to try to fill, rather than sending some. Getting it online is a bunch of crap, in my opinion. It's not going to get them what they need. They'll get enough to be able to get off your little list, maybe.
Hopefully they're right.
But I don't know. I just think we should maybe take the initiative and see if we can figure out something with Mike Richards and have them look at just a very short-term program that could be put together for folks that might be cheaper and more relevant in the long run. Just a thought.
Yeah, no, and I do agree that more community resources would be helpful for this, because it is our goal to give them tools to assist them to make them a successful restaurant, to leave an A on the wall so that they maintain their business and their customers and are serving safe food, certainly.
If you send a list of what you mentioned, where the courses are, I'm happy to take a look at it and then see if I can reach out to somebody.
Sure, sure.
I'm just glad we got rid of that stupid film.
And
the film that I watched 37 years ago when I got my first card, and they finally got rid of it, 3 years ago now?
Approximately, yes. And also keep in mind that this is 1% of 1% of facilities that have downgrades. So staff are out in the field educating the operators, really trying to dialogue, communicate with them, which can be challenging for certain languages when we're in the field. But a considerable amount of boots on the ground time is spent in the facilities before anyone ever reaches this administrative process.
And that's very helpful. And I know we don't have a multilingual inspectors of your 53 that are out there either. Do we have a number of folks that might at least be some are bilingual in any way?
Mm-hmm, we do.
In which languages do you know offhand?
Offhand, my knowledge is primarily Spanish, but we do have some now in the Asian dialects.
And maybe through their chambers or something, we could find folks that could assist as well, because sometimes it's just a language barrier more than not wanting to do it. So maybe there's some other ways to trigger some of that.
That's one thing we encourage with the food safety assessment meetings, too, is that, you know, they're encouraged to either bring somebody with them to translate, or we can arrange to have a translator for them. The bonus in that type of the food safety assessment meeting is that we're catching them before we're actually issuing the permit, and because we're having them actually demonstrate what they know to us and kind of noodle through how they're going to control those risk factors, they internalize it better. So we're hoping that they're then going to be able to sustain those practices, because it's not us handing them a stack of paper saying, here, do this. It's them thinking about how they can control those risk factors themselves in their facility.
Do you need your paperwork translated?
Some of it we already have translated. We've had it translated internally. So,
okay. Because if you do,
in other languages, there's some resources I could maybe give you then.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's good to know.
How many of those 222 do you think were non-English speaking?
You offered to translate it to Italian?
You know, I didn't look at that. I could look back and see.
Is it half,
see?
A quarter, most of them?
It's probably half.
Anyone else?
Mr. Chairman, I just
grazie
like
tanto.
I'd like to say I just feel these presentations today show a lot of hard work being done and done in a good, focused way, and you should be complimented.
Thank you.
I agree. Mm-hmm. Good point.
Thank you. We do appreciate the time you put into it, and it is good to have these presentations come to us. We get to see a little bit more in detail what you do on a day-to-day basis that we don't always get a firm grasp of, and I really enjoy this part of the meeting, so appreciate it.
And Mr. Chairman, could I ask one other question? Is there a possibility that sometime in the future you could tell me how the health district handles the vendors that are vendoring out of carts?
Absolutely,
and how they're
yeah.
vendoring out of little trailers and things like that? If we could have a presentation on that, I just get overloaded with that in the summer.
Yeah, it's an ongoing issue that we've been around.
But if you would sometime have that,
sure,
I would appreciate
it. Sure, we can do that.
It.
And I'm sure you know, for us, it's a safety issue, among other things. But we'll bring all that information back to you.
Right, and a health issue, people not using
Certainly
gloves.
Certainly it's a health issue. I'm sorry, it's a safety issue for our inspectors. But it's also a health issue for anyone who buys the food. That's correct.
I don't agree. I'm sorry.
I
don't agree with that. But.
Well, I have to tell you, on an elementary school, I saw people, you know, pulling the corn out with their hands. I mean, their gloves were not used whatsoever. And it was right, and they had breaks around the time of when school let out. And I was concerned about the children. I'm going to tell you, recently, a lot of things I've been through. I'm watching germs all over the place now, even though I believe in you. Don't watch.
Less germ, but don't get me started now.
Well, no, I do think maybe if we had a little bacteria earlier on, we might be better protected.
Exactly. You build up the immunity.
Thank you.
I just wanted to add, too, about the illegal vending. We are working closely with Metro and other entities to help provide support when we go out to these areas. There are very dangerous neighborhoods. Rose Henderson has worked on policies as well to fine line what we need to do for illegal vendors. I just wanted to add real quickly, just a reminder that we are working collaboratively with industry on formalizing our food regulation, our food code model, and our aquatic health code model. And the meetings are going very well. Jackie Race Curl is the lead project officer for this, and it's a great feat so far. So any questions so far about what we're doing, what we have been doing? There's a lot of things we're doing. We just don't have the time today to tell you what's going on.
Yes.
I was going to make the point in board reports, and I agree with you that the Model Aquatic Health Code and the food regs are progressing well. They're right now in the committee meetings with industry. I'm hearing some requests to try to separate those two regulatory codes so that we're not doing them at the same time, and maybe just focus now on the aquatic code and then follow up at a later time with the food code, if we can consider that.
Excuse me, with all due respect, the aquatic code is not on the agenda, so please, if you could make your comment during board reports.
Or if you could wait for the CHO reports.
All right.
She mentioned the aquatic, so he could make a comment. But
yes, I absolutely agree. I just didn't get a chance to interrupt her. That's all.
That's all I have to say. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We will move to the board reports. Does any board member have anything to report? Bill?
I'd just like to make a request, perhaps at the next meeting, that we have a little bit more detailed summary of what's going on in the legislature. State legislature is. Are you going to?
I'm going to talk a little bit about that under legislative agenda.
Okay.
Sorry.
Anyone else?
I would echo what Tim was speaking about, because I have to go, about the aquatics, but since it's not on the agenda, I'm hearing the same thing from the industry, is to separate the two issues and maybe focus on one right now.
Just for clarification, it's absolutely appropriate to bring it up during board reports. Mm-hmm. Because the initial presentation was not on aquatics.
Right. Well, I believe I will.
We'll have an answer for you in a few minutes.
During the health officer reports.
You know, I do have a comment.
Go ahead, Bob.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When I joined the board, the concept of having this evening meeting once a year was to elicit greater public participation, of which I have not noted any.
There isn't any. Go back to regular meetings.
And as well, at that point in the organization's evolution, I believe it was rare for a board meeting to exceed 60 minutes.
Correct. Oh, 15.
And so I'm thinking that we should perhaps return this to a regular daytime schedule.
I would agree, Mr. Chair.
I think that we will be in, about 6 months, giving you a board schedule for next year, and I can guarantee you that staff agrees with you, including this one.
I was concerned I'd make people mad, but all right.
You can make people mad in other ways if you choose.
I never heard that concern before.
Okay. Any other board reports? All right, we will move on to the health officer and staff reports and turn the time to Dr. Iser.
Thank you. We actually have something under each one of those four items, so I'll start with the CHO comments, go to Andy for building update, back to me for legislative, and then back to Andy and me for other informational items. So for my comments, one of the things I wanted to mention was that next month we should be bringing to you an update and a recommendation for the model pool code based on CDC recommendations. And the following month we'll be bringing back to you the model FDA food code. That would be the subsequent month. So April, you'll get this thing that you tabled, and you'll also get the model food code, model pool code. And then in May, you'll get the model food code. They'll be a month apart.
If I could comment on that, I believe that the industry meetings go through May, just looking at the aquatics code. And following that, the expectation is that there would then be some public workshops. So I think that's a pretty fast time frame.
It could be, and we'll do everything correct.
So I think that coming with it in April is beyond
it could
expectation.
Be. That's what,
so that's, I would really see it happening more, a month of June or July to get through the public workshops and then bring it back to the board.
It could be that long, but I'm hopeful that we can.
We don't want to drag it out,
quickly.
But at the same time, based on what meetings are scheduled, I got to think that there's going to be at least two public workshops, and if they're separated by a week or more, now we're into the middle of June.
Also, Mr. Woodbury, as you pointed out, you enjoyed this part of the presentation that just ended, and this was in Environmental Health Month, and I believe, Dr. Lockett, it's Community Health Month next month to do a little bit of a presentation like this, and then we start over with, I think it's nursing, and then administration and so on. So again, we have this four-month schedule, so you'll get a presentation like this three times a year from Environmental Health, three times a year from the other divisions as well.
So next time will be a lot of germs?
It could be.
Need to let Chris know.
We might
I
actually.
I won't be here. I'll be running in the I'll be at the Boston Marathon. So
we'll give her a cup of Listeria today.
Not running this time. I have run it, but I'm not running this time.
Also, we didn't have this agendized earlier on, but I wanted to make sure that you met. If you don't already know her, Karen Atkins, who is in the back, she is our newest manager, and she has taken over for Alice for family planning, teen pregnancy prevention, and she has graciously agreed to supervise the clinical portion of STD HIV. And I can't tell you how much we are grateful to her for stepping up and applying for the job and for being the selectee. So thank you, Karen.
Thank you, and welcome.
The third thing under the CHO comment would be, I think we sent you out a notice that we'll be hosting the county health rankings in 2 days. You're invited to come. It's 2 to 4 p.m. on Wednesday here. We would like you to register. If you'd like to and you want to come, send your name to me or to Jackie, and we'll register you for you. We already have about 60 to 70 people registered. What the county health rankings are is an annual process done by the University of Wisconsin, and they use a variety of data that's publicly available, and they rank counties. So we can tell you as a preview that only 16 of our 17 counties has enough data to be ranked. But there are counties that are far healthier than ours and counties that are less healthy than ours under these rankings. But we'll be doing a presentation and talking about our next steps. It includes the community health assessment, the community health improvement plan, and the strategic plan. So we would invite you to come to that. Again, it'll be in this room, 2 to 4 on Wednesday.
I registered.
We did see your name on there.
It was not an alias.
Yeah. And it was easy to do. So, Andy, if you'll just do the building update, please.
Andy Glass, Director of Administration.
I think it is on.
Several things on the building. First of all, is that we have selected a contractor, Martin Harrison. Thank you very much. Has been selected as the construction manager for the building. We had four applicants altogether, and Martin Harrison showed up as the most economical, as well as bringing the best package to the district. The second thing is, in reviewing the schedule, and the schedule, as you remember, is to have us out of this building by the end of this year, has been reaffirmed by Martin Harris. Thirdly, is that we brought a picture of the schematics of the building as they currently exist, and I'd be happy to go over that, but also recognizing the hour. I don't know how much you want to go, so I can give a real synopsis. Yellow is community health. The areas that are magenta or pink, I don't know, my wife tells me I'm colorblind, so I don't know what color that is, some shade of red, are all the administrative support areas. The blue areas are the nursing and clinical areas, and the green is environmental health. In conjunction with the budget that we put together for the building itself, we're in the process of working with the city for the application for redevelopment funds. And we're really looking forward to that, because with those funds, depending on what and how much we get, we can do some very significant enhancements to the building, including the build-out of the shop areas, which, as you're looking at the drawings, would be on the far left. There are four small shop areas there, as well as significantly enhancing the safety, security, and aesthetic appeal of the buildings, both inside and out. So we're real happy with that. Anybody have any questions concerning the building? Thank you.
I might add, and I know that at least you have been aware, that we've had some prolonged discussions with the intermediary buyer, and I'm not sure if I mentioned this at our last one-on-one meeting, but those have concluded successfully on all counts. So we own the building, we have agreements in place for sharing of bills and a variety of other things. There may be some pieces that we'll clearly work on together to make us a stronger unit altogether, but we want to be good neighbors. They want to be good neighbors, and I think that we're well on our way to doing that. One of the things most recently that happened just a week and a half ago was to make sure that we had their person on site, so that as our construction people start to put up fences and do things, so that we can connect with them to make sure that we are being a good neighbor to them.
Thank you, Andy.
Anybody left?
There's not much. There still is the Pizza Hut, the dry cleaners, there was a nail salon, and if you go farther over, Lima Limon, which is a sit-down restaurant, but I believe that that's it. But he ought to be marketing very aggressively now.
He should be.
Right. And we're happy to be in that neighborhood. It's going to be a quick move for us. Quick in terms of the distance from where we are now. And so we're very happy with that location and how it's building out. I think you remember, and I don't mean to go on too long, but those three buildings on the bottom left are where we're going to have vital records, food handler cards, some fee collections for those entities, and EMS. And it looks like Mary Ellen is gone. So we'll have those where they can stay open at different hours than the rest of the building. For the legislative update, within the last couple of weeks, I've testified on the EMS bill that I think you all know about. It was very favorably received by the Senate, but the fee part of it was taken off. Dan is working at trying to get some money set aside for the trauma registry, which we might be able to work on with the state, but it would go to the state instead of to us. So in the longer run, we hope that that would help to balance out our EMS program, but in the shorter run, it won't. We did do a presentation on e-cigarettes. That was, again, very well received by Mr. Oskarson's committee. And over the next week or so, we'll be, I think Bonnie today testified about HIV.
Did provide a testimony. They put the time of the hearing on us, but we still got our testimony.
So that's on the new HIV testing bill, which looks at who can test, what are labs, what is defined as a lab to be able to do that. And we're in favor of it. In fact, we worked, according to Marlo and Bonnie, we worked on developing that legislation with them. There will be several bills meeting with the tobacco and e-cigarettes. So we are in favor of having e-cigarettes regulated in the same way that cigarettes are. So that's one of the things that we'll be pursuing. We would certainly be happy if the legislature chose to tax them as well, although we wouldn't be a recipient of that, I'm sure. There will be a mental health bill that I'll be testifying at. On the tobacco issue, we've actually been working in collaboration with Dr. Green, the Attorney General, and many others in trying to – there are three bills out there, I believe, now. Is that correct? Three bills that we're trying to put into one, at least from our side point of view. There's another bill that will be on obesity that will define that, and we'll be developing testimony for that, too.
That was this afternoon.
Oh, that was this afternoon.
So Dan went ahead and testified on
that. So Dan testified for us on that. There are other things, and you've seen what the legislative agenda is. What the legislative agenda is. Do you have any other questions in that? There will be other things that will come up, so.
I have a question. I've been gone for a while, but has anything come up at the legislature concerning the reorganization of this committee? Has any bill been dropped?
Yes, there have been bills that have come out that have looked at eliminating all of the appointeds, at eliminating the seconds, the
alternates,
and in looking at how we're organized internally in terms of the chief health officer. So there, I won't be testifying at those. It is too self-serving, but there will be others who will be testifying.
And will you let us know, or somebody let us know when that occurs?
What are those bill numbers?
One is Bill 232,
yeah,
which is scheduled for this Friday before the Health and Human Services Committee.
Assembly bill?
Assembly bill.
Yeah, it's Tyrone Thompson's.
That's Tyrone Thompson's.
And the other one is Roberson's.
The other one is Roberson's, and I don't know if that's been scheduled
and
yet.
Just to set the record clear on the Roberson bill, it doesn't eliminate all the appointed. It leaves three in place and eliminates the other three.
Thank you.
And there's an advisory.
And there's an advisory board, yes.
Right.
So the Roberson bill's not, it's quite a bit different than the Thompson bill.
It is, but yes. And do you know when that bill is being scheduled?
It doesn't have a schedule yet. It's going to go 314.
SB 314 is that bill. So AB 232 is this Friday at 12 or 12:30, I believe. Is that correct?
I don't know. It's on adjournment, so it doesn't have a set time.
Okay. Any other questions on the legislative agenda?
Well, I have to say that after serving in that body for 5 terms, I was never able to figure out what the legislative agenda was this early on. So my hat's off.
We're just listing. I think Jennifer has another listing set to go out this afternoon or tomorrow morning.
It did go out right before this meeting. The legislators' bills, the deadline was last week, so I have a lot to add. And then the committee bills dropped today, so as soon as I get all those added, I'll send out a number.
What's the deadline for passage out of the first house?
April something, in about 2 weeks, in about 2 or 3 weeks.
Under other, Andy?
One of the issues that was raised at the last board meeting concerned our director of environmental health. And to make a long story short, between myself and Shirley Oakley, who's the manager for our
HR,
human resources, we talked to many, many people, including 3 of the board members. We talked to the chief executive from the Restaurant Association. In addition, we talked to the managers and supervision within the Environmental Health Division, as well as to the individual who raised those questions. And again, to make a long story short, those comments were found to be totally unfounded. They were not substantiated in any way in talking to any of the people that we talked to. And I just felt that it was important to bring that message back to the board.
The final thing that I have is that, since I've been here, there's been a level of discourtesy that I've seen down in all of the divisions, in fact, rude behavior. And I don't think that I want to live in a place where that goes on. So when we had the supervisors meeting, then when we had the all-staff meeting, I brought that up, that we should expect to have courtesy and at all times, and that means including in testimony to you, which I think you see exhibited virtually all the time. But there are times when people are discourteous, and when there are personal attacks that I don't think should be tolerated. That doesn't try to stop anyone from saying anything to each other that is appropriate related to work, or anyone from stating whatever they want to do in front of the board. But I think we need to emphasize a level of courtesy as we do that. So I would ask your help in trying to go forward with a level of courtesy that we all deserve from each other, from the board towards us, from us towards you.
Thank you. I do. Tim, go ahead.
My understanding is the employee satisfaction survey is about to be issued, if it hasn't already been done so.
It's been out for a week and a day and 2 hours, and it's supposed to be finished by this coming Friday. Is Shirley here? And we're up to, what's the percentage?
As of the end of day Thursday, it was 46% participation.
So I think that we'll, hopefully we'll see 60, 70, 80% participation. By then, and it'll probably be past April by the time we can give past the April board meeting by the time that we can.
Yes.
Okay. But you did get a copy of that. We, you know, we Jackie and Marcy take down all of your requests, and we try to get them to you. If we don't think it rises to the level of a board meeting, we try to get those to you in the interim between one meeting and the next.
All right. And so we will move on to informational items, which you have before you, and to our final public comment, if there are any members of the public still here. Do we have anyone wishing to speak? All right. Well, we appreciate everybody sticking it out tonight and everybody that's participated, and meeting adjourned until next month.
We'll be adjourned at 7:39.
I didn't know if you wanted me to follow you someplace.
No, it's good job.
Because it was the closest.